Caverly. Lou Caverly and I are bringing you cutting-edge news for Christians on the Divided Kingdom program. We deeply appreciate the help listeners can give us to stay on the air. We accept cash and postal stamps and checks or money orders if they're made out to WWCR. We cannot take checks made out to us personally. And we also treasure letters of encouragement as we try to expose evil and witness to the omniscient power, love, and forgiveness of our precious Savior, Jesus Christ. And here is the address if you would like to help us or write to us. That is Lou, capital L-O-U, Caverly, capital C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, P.O. Box 28, Bethlehem, capital B-E-T-H-L-E-H-E-M, Maryland. And the zip is 21609. And again, that is Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And also, on a previous program, we talked about my calling the Prophecy Club and having a good discussion with Sean Johnson, Stan Johnson's son, and getting him to offer a series for just the Divided Kingdom listeners, and that would be 10 DVDs for $100. That's a wonderful bargain, and only $5 shipping. So if any of you want to think about some of these DVDs, I selected the 10 that I thought were very, very good. There isn't apostasy in them, and they're very cutting edge. Two with Ted Gunderson, I believe, one with Colonel Jim Ammerman, several recent DVDs that are very good. And the one that we thought was the top DVD of all was Deborah Ray's The ABCs of Globalism. It's so inclusive of all the things that you need to know. So if you would like to call them and find out more about getting these DVDs, this special offer for the Divided Kingdom, $100 plus $5 shipping, their telephone number is 785-266-1112. And again, that is 785-266-1112. And we get absolutely nothing from them. We are in a completely independent program, and I hope that you realize how very rare that is, and that those of you who do have a lot of money may think about trying to save your country. We are walking down a dark road, a road hidden in an even deeper forest, when suddenly there it is, the building that has been there for almost 250 years. As we get closer, I find it reminds me on its exterior quite a bit of the old colonial era brick tavern called Heidi Ho near Shellsburg, Pennsylvania, the one that I recall so clearly from my days growing up in the beautiful Allegheny Mountains of western Pennsylvania. Today, Heidi Ho is transformed to being part of a camping ground, and the trees around it are so tall and thick that it can no longer be seen from the road that passes it. This building we are approaching is coming into view. The first impression is one of faded grandeur, but as one draws closer, it is evident that the bricks have fallen to a large degree. The supports have weakened. Slimy moss and flying bats are everywhere. What is this? Hotel Halloween? Even the unsettling cry of an owl is heard, mocking our ease. No, an ancient placard on the stately columns surrounding the front steps reads, Hotel America. Another sign just below it says, sold out to new owners. We are going through the door, uninvited, to explore some of the rooms, some of the deep, dark, disturbing changes to this once fine resort hotel. As we enter the front hall, a gremlin statue composed of rotting algae confronts us. The gremlin's arms are holding an iron rack. Tacked to the rack are newspaper clippings and assorted papers. A heading in black letters proclaims Achievements of the New Owners. Stealthily creeping closer to this creature, a creature that doesn't seem to be fake, nor is it fully alive, but exudes the rotten smell of decay, death, and some kind of carcass robot sickening AI chimera, we read. And as we look at it, and we're just overwhelmed by this horrible smell, we read the first newspaper clipping. The Los Angeles Times, October 2017. Governor Jerry Brown has signed into law a bill that changes from a felony to a misdemeanor the crime of donating HIV-positive blood knowingly. The other papers attached appear to be addendums from secret inner circle meetings of huge pharmaceutical companies. Prominently displayed also is a huge blown-up photo of the Georgia Guidestones in Elberton, Georgia. One of these monuments, Ten Commandments, is listed in big black letters beside the photo. Keep the earth in balance with a population of 500 million. We turn and we hear moans and hisses coming from closed doors all up and down the halls of this almost ruined beyond repair building. Dirty needles and half-used packets of white powder litter the hallway as far as one can see. We see a tape recorder discarded in the debris of bottles and needles. We stop out of curiosity and flick it on. Easton Star Democrat, Easton, Maryland, September 21st, 2017. My daughter is 25 and is in rehabilitation for the 15th time for heroin addiction. She, her boyfriend, and her three-year-old son live with us. Her boyfriend, Hank, and we point out in this tape that all names have been changed, who has an addiction to cocaine, was in recovery for a long time. About 6 weeks ago, he relapsed and was afraid to tell us, so he didn't come home. It scared us to death because it was so out of character for him. We have been helping with our grandson, but Hank gave him his baths, got him dressed, read to him, and did puzzles with him. He is constantly doing things with his son because he does not want him to have additional issues after being born addicted to heroin. We knew Hank had gone out with friends the last night we saw him. My husband had a cardiac catheter placed that day, and we were calling jails and hospitals looking for Hank. His phone had been stolen. He wasn't sleeping much, and he was out and about on the streets between Annapolis and Baltimore. He finally called at 1 a.m., about a week and a half after he left. We told him we were thankful he was alive. He cried and said he couldn't believe he had done this to his son. He grew up with a father who had addiction. Children of addicted parents have feelings of abandonment as well as low self-worth, and the cycle continues. They believe they are destined to be like their parents. Our pastor got Hank a hotel room for the night, and the next morning my husband went to Baltimore and got him. We worked with the rehabilitation center where our daughter is, and they helped Hank get into rehab the very next day. Now, both of our grandson's parents are in rehab, and both are doing well. His father will be out of rehab in a few weeks, and then we'll go to a halfway house. I don't want to raise a three-year-old. I'm in my 50s, and I've raised my kids, but he is the most adorable, loving, sweet little guy, and there's no way we would do anything else. Ours is the only home he's ever known. Our daughter has been in rehab so many times, our grandson asks if we're going to Mommy's house because he thinks that rehab is her house. Her little boy is so sweet and just as happy as can be. That little boy loves his mama. He loves her so much. I told her recently he won't remember this time when he's older, but if it goes on much longer, he will. If she continues in relapse, that's what his life is going to be. A child wonders what he did to make his parents leave him. After the last time she relapsed, she told me that there is not enough heroin around to forget her son because she tried. Each time she shut up, she was hoping she wouldn't wake up. It's terrible for her. She cries. She loves him, and when she's clean, she's a good mom. She also has mental health issues such as anxiety and depression. Unless she is vigilant about assuming responsibility for her mental health as well as her physical health, then she relapses because she feels better and she's not taking her medicine. This little boy does not deserve to start his life like this. Life is hard enough as it is, and you have these people who love him so much, but they have this disease. Addiction is a chronic, long-term condition. There is no cure, but there is treatment. If we want to fix the opioid epidemic, we're going to have to fight to make sure that treatment becomes available. I look forward to the day that our grandson has the life he should have, living with younger parents who can do the things with him younger parents have the energy to do. Will we have the nerve to explore and open the hidden doors of this house, this inn, this decrepit thing called Hotel America? Or will we turn around, flee through the forest, and close our eyes to the fact many of the trees outside the hotel are now being bulldozed, and clearly the operations of this fearsome resort are being enlarged, more foundations being laid, the activity moving ever closer to the roads that lead to the homes where you and I spend our everyday lives? Is it not time to know the awful truth, to begin opening the hidden doors, to stand up as Christians in the war against Satan, against the darkness of evil, and have God shine the light of Jesus' victory as we always pray for America to repent and be restored? We look inside the book called The True Story of the Bilderberg Group by Daniel Estulin, and in this group, in this book, we get the take of what the goals are for the New World Order. And, of course, we see that the idea here is no middle class, only rulers and servants. A zero-growth society. In a post-industrial period, zero growth will be necessary to destroy vestiges of general prosperity. When there is prosperity, there is progress. Prosperity and progress make it impossible to implement repression, and you need repression if you hope to divide society into owners and slaves. The end of prosperity will bring an end to the production of nuclear-generated electric power and all industrialization except for the computer and service industries. The remaining Canadian and American industries would be exported to poor countries such as Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Nicaragua, where slave labor is cheap. One of the principal objectives for NAFTA will then be realized. The second point is a state of perpetual imbalance. By artificially manufacturing crises that will put people under continual duress, physically, mentally, and emotionally, it is possible to keep people in a perpetual state of imbalance. Too tired and strung out to decide their own destinies, populations will be confused and demoralized to the extent that, faced with too many choices, apathy on a massive scale will result. And we're very much heartened to see more truth coming out about the Las Vegas shooting when 59 people were killed. We're seeing even the mainstream media, including Newsweek, is having to admit that ISIS was probably involved. The sheriff himself said there were multiple shooters. This is one more example, we think, of keeping us in this perpetual imbalance. The third point is centralized control of all education. We see that coming more and more. The New Freedom Initiative that first emerged its ugly head in the Bush years is back to a certain degree, in which the schools are going to be examining the children psychologically, and they're going to be providing services. Now, we can easily imagine these services involve going to get Gardasil, which will probably sterilize the girls and take a lot of them out with autoimmune diseases. All of these evil things are part of this pharmaceutical medical complex, which we're going to get into much more tonight. Centralized control of all foreign and domestic politics. President Trump has thwarted some of this. We are so glad to applaud him for getting us out of the carbon agreement and getting us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Empowerment of the United Nations, Western Trading Bloc. And here, Daniel Estulin says, by expanding NAFTA throughout the Western Hemisphere into South America, the American Union will eventually form similar to the European Union. expansion of NATO as the UN intervenes in more trouble spots globally, as it is in Afghanistan now, NATO becomes the UN's world army. And as we've said many times on this program, in 2007, we believe it was, when Georgia was invaded, it was not invaded by Russia first, not at all. It was the West. NATO powers went into Georgia, and then Russia sprang to a defense of the enclaves that had always traditionally been theirs, like South Ossetia. One legal system, and that would mean the International Court of Justice is to become the sole legal system for the world. We will fight this till our dying breath, and having Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court is a good step ahead. And another good step is having Judge Roy Moore in the Senate. And we ask all of you in Tennessee to really support Marsha Blackburn. We remember when she came on the Call to Decisions program and talked about the TSA. It was so important. She wanted those thugs stopped. She's a grandmother. So all of those of you who are in Tennessee and love liberty, really get the vote out for her. One socialist welfare state. This is some of what is planned, you see. And one of the big, big things that's helping to weaken us is this kind of a big world cartel, and we're going to get right into it.
Quoting the late writer, investigator, Jim Keith's book, Mass Control, Engineering Human Consciousness. With the advent of advanced technology for mind control and people control, we stand at the edge of an abyss. We are at that moment in history where the controllers can do away with what little freedom the human race still possesses and chain every aspect of the life of mankind to their own parasitic purposes. We are at the point where it is feasible that the destiny of mankind can be owned and can be molded and shaped with the ease of shaping clay. A revolution is taking place in the United States, instituted by the controllers, whose agents have learned their materialist, immoral philosophies at the knee of monsters like Cameron and Delgado. They are putting in place mind control technologies, advanced surveillance, computerization, indoctrination, prisons, and other people control technologies that will render freedom meaningless and obsolete, syllables fallen from the lips of a mind controlled moron. They are launching new assaults on people's lives every minute. Using these new and old technologies, dissent and original thought are being ripped from us. And I, Lou Cavalier, have to interject an example of that proves Jim Keith's point. Twitter-censored conservative grandmother Marsha Blackburn's senatorial campaign tweet, in which she exulted in, quote, stopping Planned Parenthood under God, unquote. And I'm glad to say that they've retracted that now, and I guess they are going to allow her campaign tweet. Facebook and YouTube examples of demonetizing patriotic and conservative voices are increasing rapidly. Keith continues, using these new and old technologies, dissent and original thought are being ripped from us. Traditions of individual sovereignty and freedom are being expunged from our minds and from the history books. And due to the multitudes of anesthetics we have been shot up with, we don't feel a thing. Again, this is Lou speaking. Elizabeth and I are bringing you a vital breaking news investigation tonight about one of these areas of anesthesia, the opioid crisis, and the sinister connections.
Yes, Lou, we have talked on this program before about Pat Tillman, who was killed by so-called friendly fire before he could return home and report in on the CIA governmental support of the Afghanistan poppy fields. And though we do not agree with some of the religious doctrines, such as universal salvation, of Dr. James Bergamon, host of the radio program Feed My Sheep, and not so much emphasis on what he calls the Edomites, but at the same point, we have to applaud his series that is exposing the worldwide witchcraft and the pharmakia of Mystery Babylon. In it, Bergamon quotes a book called Dope, Inc., and he discusses the allegation that Mitch McConnell's wife, Secretary of Transportation, Elaine Chao's family, has a business called Foremost, and this is a huge global shipping company. And supposedly, allegedly, there was an incident in Colombia in which drugs were found along with the other commodities in Foremost ships. We're not sure whether that was cocaine or heroin, and we're just saying this, that we have to not take anything at face value. And it's very, very important that we get some of these Republicans, these rhinos, out. We have to put in patriots. We have to put on in people who really care about our country. And you see, God is giving us some success with Judge Roy Moore. It's so important.
Jim Keats warns us, quote, if we do not succeed in stopping the controllers, ultimately the only people left will be the marching morons, the gullible, and those so apathetic as to have entirely forgotten that freedom can exist. People should be reminded that the individual sovereignty of our minds and bodies is our most valuable possession. We must educate the populace about the programs of control that have gone on for at least the latter half of the 20th century. We must expose mind control programs that are currently going on in the military, in religious cults, and in psychiatric experiments, in the media, and see to it that these operations are brought to an end.
Yes, Lou, as Keith mentions, currently going on in military mind control programs by military analyst James Wesley Rawls, he says that, was Stephen Paddock a possible mind control example? And his girlfriend spoke of him lying awake at night, continually screaming. Even if Newsweek has now somewhat acquiesced to him being connected to ISIS, something alternative news has been saying from the outset, this does not rule out U.S. intelligence community Manchurian candidate collusion in the globalist plan to use radical Islam to foment crisis and takedown. And as we pointed out earlier, listeners, to keep us all demoralized and upset. I'm not upset. I'm trusting in my Savior, Jesus Christ, and I'm looking to more victories. And when you hear, America is gone, America is gone, this may not be alternative radio. This may be a very, very clever kind of propaganda. Perhaps unwittingly, these radio hosts are doing this, but God told us not to have a spirit of fear, and we are to stand up against the evil. So the fact that this sheriff also believes more than one shooter was involved lends credence to a planned, purposeful, false flag event, not to mention how quickly CFR Bilderberg puppet Dianne Feinstein, hand in your guns, Mr. and Mrs. America, came out to squawk for changing the gun rights. We've got to get rid of some of those, I forget the technical name of it, Lou. Do you remember when they can do all the rounds at once? Anyway, right now it won't come to me, but we know that they feel that there was a belt series going on. Yes, with all of these things happening, the question is, with these shootings, Fort Hood, Orlando, Aurora, San Bernardino, who are the controllers? Again, Lou, what does Jim Keith conclude?
Jim Keith concludes his vital book, Mass Control, Engineering Human Consciousness, with these words, mind control, fascism, to be turned worldwide into a hot-button topic, so that at the mere mention of new incursions on our freedom, the public uproar will be overwhelming. We must force government to open all files on mind control and related experimentation. We must end the mass control of mankind in our lifetime. The address to buy Keith's book, Mass Control, is 1 Adventure Place, Post Office Box 74, Kempton, K-E-M-P-T-O-N, Illinois. The zip is 60946, and the phone number is 815-253-6390. And I'll repeat that. 1 Adventure Place, Post Office Box 74, Kempton, K-E-M-P-T-O-N, Illinois, 60946. And the phone number is 815-253-6390. The price may still be $16.95 with $3 for shipping. And as Elizabeth and I watch TV drug ads, I often comment to her how bizarre it is that drug descriptions often warn that they may cause death by the very disease or condition they are supposed to prevent. At the same time, a neighboring community has a group of parents and the local sheriff doing an extensive awareness campaign to try to stop the opioid crisis that is killing numbers of teenagers and adults. Tonight is only the beginning of this story. From the New York Review of Books, title is Author Reveals the True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic. Opiate addiction is all about pain, the pain of addicts constantly seeking relief from torment and their friends and relatives dealing with the fallout. It is also about hunger, the hunger of corporations and dealers on the dark side of the narco world for profits, and the hunger of caring crusaders like Sam Quinones to stop this human tragedy. Quinones is a veteran journalist and expert storyteller, long steeped in the demimonde of Mexican-American border crossings. Dreamland, the true tale of America's opiate epidemic, is an intricate jigsaw puzzle piecing together his findings from intensive investigation of the unprecedented spread of heroin addiction throughout the United States over the past two decades. Through participant observation, involving interviews with addicts and their relatives, Mexican farm boys turned entrepreneurs, narco bosses, lawmen, pioneering drug researchers, doctors, and other public health personnel, Quinones weaves together a haunting account of how the underground drug culture of addiction surged like wildfire, fanned by the complicity of the medical profession and Big Pharma. That again is from the New York Journal of Books.
And that leads us into the important Karatek investigation. This article is by Carol Valentine and James Spoonius. Globalism, opioids, and a monetization of disease. And we can't thank a 90-year-old investigative reporter who keeps her eyes open for everything for our program. We cannot thank her enough. She had a note on this. Did we see this in the news? Mm-mm, we certainly didn't. Webster's Dictionary defines a think piece as a piece of writing meant to be thought-provoking and speculative that consists chiefly of background material and personal opinion analysis. We say this at the outset because we do rely upon facts, not on controversy, but we connect dots in ways few, if any, have done. We posit that this crisis didn't appear as a coincidence, but had coordination, planning. We can't prove this. We have no direct evidence and honestly don't want it. While we understand some may disagree with the planned aspect of this story, we ask doubting readers to overlook our point and realize that no matter how this happened, no one can deny the opportunistic cashing in on misery and virtual non-punishment of multi-billion-dollar criminal activity which has not been abated. With that, we summarize this complex subject, then delve into the story. A summary. Think about this. Deindustrialization, also known as globalism, free trade, and neoliberalism, just happened upon America in the 1970s, coming completely destroying what was industrial America. Highly persuasive propagandists on the left and right told Americans that they would be working in the service industry, which would pay as much, if not more, than the factory work that would soon disappear. Alvin Toffler's books, Future Shock and Third Wave, which promoted an information-slash-service economy as the future, became Bibles of President Bill Clinton and House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who used their clout to pass a variety of free trade agreements. As factories leave, jobs follow them. Once proud communities resemble ghost towns, especially places like Portsmouth, Ohio. Just on the heels of economic misery, Purdue Pharma markets opioids, notably OxyContin, a synthetic painkiller, to economically distressed areas, putting Purdue's owners, the Sackler family, in the top tier of billionaires, according to Forbes magazine. Small-town folk who used to do factory work become recipients of Social Security Disability, SSI, and given ever more prescriptions for pain. Pain clinics appear with doctors writing OxyContin prescriptions in record numbers. Wait times reach several hours in some of the clinics. OxyContin pills become a currency, literally. They are traded for goods and services. Walmart replaces small stores, employing some of the people crushed by the deindustrialization. Thievery at Walmart becomes rampant, with dealers and others giving lists of items to steal at Walmart, which apparently wasn't terribly affected economically by blatant theft, but it gets worse. Illegal heroin finds its way to the same areas plagued by opioids. Opioid users switch to black tar heroin for a variety of reasons. Black tar heroin is cheaper, stronger, and one doesn't need a prescription to obtain it. Xalisco, Mexico becomes the main producer of black tar heroin, which coincidentally is marketed in the same communities as opioids. Black tar heroin traffickers are highly organized, but decentralized. They focus on middle and upper class whites as customers, and according to the script, do not compete with established heroin traffickers operating relatively freely under state and federal police. Sam Quinones writes Dreamland, a best-selling must-read book that tells the story of Portsmouth, Ohio's opioid epidemic and the Mexican drug cartel that sells black tar heroin. People die from opioids and black tar heroin in record-breaking numbers. The New York Times in 2017 writes that more than 60,000 deaths can be attributed to opioids and black tar heroin. The, quote, news cycle focuses on the, quote, plight of opioid addiction, with pleas for federal funding for rehabilitation, which has proven to be less than helpful. American wages are on par with Chinese employers. The admission of China into the World Trade Organization in 2002 drove world labor costs down, making the global economic elite richer than ever. The powers that be posit that the healthcare industry, 17.5% of the gross domestic product, does that shock you? I have to interject, wow, has replaced our industrial economy. They scream that replacing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, would cause massive job loss, as reported in the New York Times in 2017. The implications of a healthcare economy, which is actually a disease, death care economy, are frightening because sick and diseased people are now absolutely essential to economic sustenance and growth. Think about this. A new economy that profits from people's diseases, such as cancer, drug addiction, or liver transplants, is touted as the new norm. The old system of producing goods, such as raw materials and finished goods, steel, clothing, or shoes, in the United States is no more, as we are told. What isn't said, though, is that in a healthcare economy, sick and diseased Americans are essential to keep it flowing. Is this why America faces so many environmental assaults, such as GMOs, herbicides, Wi-Fi, fluoride, vaccinations, and so many more, with virtually no regulation, while alternative therapies and healthy lifestyle products and advice are suppressed and vilified? We begin the main story. And if we don't get to complete it all tonight, we'll have another part to this, absolutely. The main story that Carol Valentine and her co-writer tell is this.
Sam Quinone's Dreamland serves as a place to start. Dreamland paints a hard-to-believe picture of how America's once-prized heartland became destitute and heroin-addicted. In what seems like remarkable symmetry, prescription opioids float in small towns, followed by cheap black tar heroin. Dreamland was the name of a pool, the size of a football field in Portsmouth, Ohio, which was built in 1929 by a local factory owner. The pool was desegregated in 1961, bringing all races together in social harmony. In 1979 and 80, Portsmouth won America's Best City Award. Quinones writes, quote, Dreamland was a summer babysitter. Parents left their children at the pool every day. Townsfolk found respite from the thick humidity at Dreamland. And then across the street to the A&W stand for hot dogs and root beer. The pool's French fries were the best around. Kids took the bus to the pool in the morning and back home in the afternoon. They came from schools all over Scotto County and all over Scotto County and met each other and learned to swim. Some of them competed on the Dreamland Dolphin Swim Team, which practiced every morning and evening. WIOI, the local radio station, knowing so many of its listeners were sunbathing next to their transistor radios at Dreamland, would broadcast a jingle, "Time to Turn So You Don't Burn," every half hour. That was a direct quote from the book Dreamland by Quinones. Portsmouth symbolized the best of middle-class America, proud, blue-collar residents who worked in factories, making good money to house and feed their families. But deindustrialization changed Portsmouth and many other American towns once known for industry into, quote, pill mills, unquote, where pain clinics wrote prescriptions without any medical scrutiny. Quinones writes that Portsmouth, Scioto County, earned the reputation of having more pill mills per capita than any other American town. Quinones says, no place in America had more of these shady clinics per capita than did Scioto County, Ohio. Over the first years of the new century, a local junkyard owner, an attorney, a prison guard, an ex-bailiff, and a couple of convicted felons, as well as several doctors, all opened clinics, hiring doctors with permits to write the prescriptions and see patients at a rapid clip. Jody Robinson cashed in his car stereo shop to open a pain clinic, which he became, according to a later indictment, one of the region's biggest pill distributors. Quinones tells us that lines were so long in these clinics that people would have pizza delivered while they waited for prescriptions. Having depressed people seeking synthetic opioids, whose effects mirror heroin, became relatively easy, given how deindustrialization broke the character of Portsmouth and many other American towns. Portsmouth once symbolized cohesiveness, a community of small business owners, factory owners and employees, people who knew each other, all enjoying the fruits of what was then a middle-class economy. Quinones explains how Walmart changed this. Quote, Walmart was often the only place to buy life's essentials in these heartland towns. Strolling their Walmarts, I imagined its aisles haunted by the ghosts of the store owners who once sustained small-town America. On one aisle was the departed local grocer. Down another, the former hardware store owner. Next to the woman's clothier, or that long-gone pharmacist. Quinones describes how Walmart became a place for addicts to steal, to pay for opiates, to either to the extent that shopping lists of desired merchandise were given to addicts to gather goods in exchange for pills. Quinone writes how, quote, the opiate scourge might never have spread as quickly as these rural areas where it all started possessed a diversity of small retailers whose owners had invested their lives in their stores, knew the addicts personally, and stood ready to defend against them, unquote. Powerful financial interest propped up Walmart and others to break competition. Walmart got huge local tax breaks and other incentives to move to communities. Small business didn't, which makes one wonder how this idea of, quote, equal protection, unquote, should actually be applied. Walmart not only paid low wages, but had the audacity to hand out manuals for employees to take advantage of welfare, Medicaid, food stamps, and other government programs. One need only gander in the abyss of the Federal Reserve System and government agencies, which may have reduced competition in specific fields, to believe that those on top got there, quote-unquote, fairly. Referring to the ruling class as our, quote-unquote, owners, who give us elections to further the idea, we have choice, the late comedian George Carlin remarked, it's a big club, and you ain't in it. We will not defend puppets of that system or the political philosophies which further the myth. Speaking of power, Forbes magazine ranked the Sackler family, manufacturers of OxyContin, as the 16th richest family at $14 billion in 2015. Forbes writes, quote, brothers Arthur, Mortimer, and Raymond Sackler, each practicing psychiatrists, bought a small, struggling drug manufacturer in New York City in 1952, which would eventually become Purdue Pharma. The brothers initially sold small-time products like laxatives and earwax remover. Arthur simultaneously was a standout in the field of medical advertising. He helped Pfizer establish itself in the prescription drug arena, and he is credited with writing scientific papers that contributed to Valium becoming the first $100 million drug, according to his listing in the Medical Advertising Hall of Fame. Quinones provides different facts in a chapter entitled Ad Man, explaining how Arthur Sackler's Ad Man, quote, wrote thousands of postcards meant to appear as if they were from Egypt, Australia, Malta, and elsewhere. They mailed these cards addressed individually to thousands of U.S. family doctors, pediatricians, and surgeons, describing how terramycin, an antibiotic cleverly named by the Sackler, was combating diseases in these exotic locales. And this is in quotes, milk fever in Malta, Q fever in Australia, unquote. The cards were signed, sincerely, Pfizer. Doctors already known to prescribe a lot of drugs got extra direct mail. Then Sackler sent salesmen on visits to doctors' offices. Along with frequent visits, medical journal advertisements, and mailings, the sales effort was all-encompassing. In 1952, terramycin earned $45 million in sales. Valium came next.
Sackler's experience with making Hoffman LaRoche's Valium a blockbuster-selling drug, the pharmaceutical industry's first $100 million drug, and then the first billion-dollar drug, paved the way for OxyContin. Sackler linked Valium's tranquilizing benefits to stress. As Wynn Gerson, Sackler's admin, explained, the patient would walk in, I'm nervous all day long, doctor, or my son's in the Army. Sackler's marketing efforts convinced family practitioners that Valium easily became a way to chill their patients. Wynn Gerson explained, people were walking around nervous, worried, and this drug absolutely calmed them. It worked for certain types of back pains. It kind of made junkies out of some people, but that drug worked. Sackler made hay with OxyContin, which contains oxycodone, synthesized from thebaine, a derivative of opium. Quinones explained that OxyContin's predecessor was MS-Contin, an opiate supposedly a continuous time-to-release formula. In the 1980s, medical schools taught that opiates were to be strictly limited in use. So severe pain, such as those that come with terminal cancer and immediately after surgery, then stopped because of how highly addictive opioids are. Purdue's OxyContin supposedly overcame addiction concerns because it was time-released, meaning that smaller, controlled amounts were supposed to be delivered in the body over a 12-hour period. Ideally, OxyContin wouldn't give the powerful rush to users, making its pain-killing effects more manageable. In 1995, the FDA approved OxyContin in many powerful doses with unusual label claims and warnings. Quinones writes that the FDA allowed Purdue to claim that OxyContin had a lower potential for abuse than other oxycodone products, because its time-release formula allowed for delay in absorbing the drug. No other manufacturer of a Schedule II narcotic drug ever got the go-ahead from the FDA to make such a claim. It was a claim that soon became a cornerstone of the marketing of OxyContin, writes Barry Meyer, author of Painkiller, a book on OxyContin. Worse yet, with a warning label that inadvertently told addicts how to abuse the pill, warning patients not to crush the tablets because that would release a potentially toxic amount of the drug, according to Quinones. For anyone familiar with modern medicine over the past 20-some years, you'll note that medical practitioners ask patients to rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10. People laugh when asked to evaluate their own pain levels, but it was the impetus for this multi-billion dollar opiate industry. Purdue Pharmaceuticals encouraged doctors to use OxyContin for non-cancer pain lasting more than a few days. Quinones writes, OxyContin ought to be used for bad backs, knee pain, tooth extraction, headaches, fibromyalgia, as well as football, hockey, and dirt bike injuries, broken bones, and of course after surgery. This was a vast new market for opiate painkillers. U.S. back pain patients alone numbered some 35 million people. The total number of cancer patients were a fifth of that. To get there, Purdue had to answer doctors' first doubt. Isn't this stuff addictive? Purdue lied by promoting the falsehood that addiction was less than 1%. It wasn't true, and Purdue admitted such after being prosecuted. Quinones, in a gripping chapter, describes how U.S. Attorney John Brownlee charged Purdue with misbranding and false advertising of OxyContin in Abington, Virginia, which is near Kentucky, and West Virginia, Quinones writes that Purdue provided no study to the FDA supporting the claim that OxyContin was not addictive. He writes that Purdue pleaded guilty to a felony count of misbranding OxyContin. To avoid federal prison sentences for its executives, the company paid a $634.5 million fine, among the largest in the history of the pharmaceutical industry at the time. Three executives paid $34.5 million of that and pled guilty to a single misdemeanor of misbranding the drug. And according to Quinones, these three executives had to perform 400 hours of community services and were placed on probation for 3 years. Quinones writes, at the sentencing hearing, Lee Nuss, the mother of a Florida man who died from an OxyContin overdose, rose to speak. "You are," she told them, "nothing more than a large corporate drug cartel." What happened next was a step toward hell. Quinones writes how heroin became a fixture in southern Ohio. Not long after the Purdue campaign hit full swing, however, Chillicothe, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, Lou, do you know in Ohio? You're not sure either. And the surrounding towns began seeing patients addicted to OxyContin. Many of them used hundreds of milligrams a day as their tolerance grew. Newly liberal prescribing put oxys everywhere. Pill mills sprouted like fungus. Soon, opiate pills were the party drug for small-town kids, who in another era might have been building bonfires and getting drunk. Dr. Philip Pryor left his private practice to devote himself full-time to his specialty in addiction medicine at the Veterans Administration in Chillicothe, Ohio. Quinones writes, then Pryor watched in amazement as heroin came to town. Heroin was as foreign to these rural white communities of southern Ohio as extraterrestrials. Wasn't it an urban drug? For blacks in Baltimore, D.C., Puerto Ricans in New York, it never had anything to do with Appalachia. Quinones writes, this heroin, too, was like nothing Pryor had ever seen, even in movies. It was sticky and dark brown like rat crap, yet potent and, above all, cheap. It was called black tar. In Columbus, Mexicans were delivering it by car like pizza at prices that were a fourth what Oxy cost and offering volume discounts. In Chillicothe and towns around Fairfield County, every addict became their salesman, looking for news clients he could parlay into enough orders to make a trip to Columbus worthwhile. From Fairfield County, the news marched south, down through a region where OxyContin had already tenderized a generation of folks to opiate use. Athens County, 90 miles southeast of Columbus, had almost no heroin ever. By 2008, 15% of the admissions to a treatment center there were related to heroin, and almost all were injecting it. In 2012, the center was treating more heroin addicts, mostly for black tar, than alcoholics. And so it went. OxyContin first introduced by reps from Purdue Pharma over steak and dessert and in air-conditioned doctor's offices. Within a few years, black tar heroin followed in tiny, uninflated balloons held in the mouths of sugarcane farm boys from Zalexco driving old Nissan Sentras to meetups in the McDonald's parking lots. Others, too, got in on the trade. Black guys from Detroit and Dayton discovered southern Ohio and brought powder heroin. Philip Pryor was now knee-deep in what was unthinkable a few years before, rural, white heroin junkies, according to Quinones. I've yet to find one who didn't start with OxyContin, Pryor told Quinones. They wouldn't be selling this quantity of heroin right on the street right now if they hadn't made these decisions in the boardroom, Pryor declared. In 2017, a New York Times headline screamed how $45 billion is needed for the opioid crisis, emphasizing the importance of rehabilitation and education. Establishment hacks aren't calling for those who got us into the crisis to pay for it, to let alone through retribution for those who knowingly made this epidemic. Instead, it's a problem taxpayers must bear, even though we are already paying exorbitant health care premiums and taxes. And this article goes on to talk about whether rehabilitation helps. And there's something very shocking, too, that the so-called rehab centers, and I'm interjecting here, they're rather short-term. And the problem is really different because after taking these drugs for a while, the brain receptors change and they cannot be put back right except over a long, long time. So this is why we see all of these repeat readmissions. And in this article, they say that it's up to 60%, but they think that's too low. Quinones talks about a young man named Matt who, after just finishing rehab, died shortly after from an overdose of street drugs. Matt's father, Paul, said, and this emphasizes what I said before, that after taking opiates, it takes 2 years for your dopamine receptors to start working naturally. Nobody told us that. We thought he was fixed because he was coming out of rehab. Kids aren't fixed. It takes years of clean living to the point where they may have a chance. This is a lifelong battle. Had we known, we would have never let Matt alone those first few vulnerable days after rehab. We let him go alone that afternoon to Narcotics Anonymous, his first day out of rehab. He had new clothes on. He looked good. He was then going to play golf with his friend. Instead of making a right turn to go to the meeting, he made a left turn, and he's buying drugs and dying. Declining wages are mentioned as a reason for the opioid crises. Is it getting better? In a barely mentioned 2017 story on Forbes.com, Kenneth Raposa argues how China-like wages are now part of the U.S. employment boom. Raposa writes how Amazon has become a major employer, paying low wages in formerly industrial cities. Taking Fall River, Massachusetts as an example, Amazon built a 1.2 million square foot warehouse getting $15 million in tax breaks with starting pay at $12.75 per hour, no degree required. For junior inventory clerks with warehousing experience, the pay is $14.70 an hour and requires a bachelor's degree. Raposa points out that workers in some parts of China have a similar standard of living to Amazon workers. The lowest paid workers in Amazon's warehouse, assuming 30 hours per week, would earn around $18,000 annually, or roughly $7,200 more than the median Chinese worker, a country where people still survive on $2,000 a year. Compared to the median wages in Beijing, a rich part of China, the $14.75 an hour hire working 30 hours a week is earning $442.50 versus Beijing's median wage of $329.53 per week. The forklift operator at $12.75 is making $382, not much more than the average guy in Beijing. No American could live on an Amazon warehouse wage without spouses, family members, and others living together. With the promised service economy promoted by neoliberal gurus, we have extremely low wages and extremely high costs. Raposa cites China's 2002 entry into the World Trade Organization as a key factor in keeping global labor costs down. And the article goes on to talk about the World Trade Organization being a game changer. You see, all these things that we told you out of the Bilderberg book, I'm interjecting again here, the plan to take down America, to take away prosperity. We need much prayer for our president, Donald Trump. We need much prayer that God will extend his mercy and give us a chance to be sorry for our sins, to stop Planned Parenthood's endeavors in our country, to stop the killing of the 60-plus million babies. Because this article here, again, says U.S. median wage growth remains subdued over the last 15 years of China's WTO entry, despite the unemployment rate dropping in half since the Great Recession. Stock market gains and declining unemployment are not translating into better pay. We know that this is true. And it's China's near-slave labor system that kept these prices low. The political and social side effect of this, according to Raposa, is lower productivity, the unskilling of blue-collar workers, and to some extent a weakening outlook for middle-income labor, particularly in the manufacturing sector. Some investments believe Chinese disruption in American labor markets is at least on par with Amazon's disruption of traditional retail. And as Quinones described how Walmart broke the back of American culture, it seems that Amazon may take it a step further into a place with less social cohesion and the robotic fulfillment of Internet orders. Healthcare, providing 17.5% of the GDP and 20% of all employment? My word. Isn't this something? These authors of the Caritech investigation say, what an irony of having sick people provide jobs for what was once an industrial economy. And while at the same time manufacturing employment has fallen nearly 40% in northeastern Ohio since 2000, and the number of healthcare jobs in that region, that number has jumped more than 30% over the same period. In Akron, the one-time rubber capital of the world, only one of the city's 10 largest employers still makes tires. Three are hospitals. That's a good thing? Well, we can see the war on the weak that Edwin Black wrote about, the euthanasia, the eugenics. It's coming. It's coming. And if we don't resist that road that we talked about where they're bulldozing, it's getting closer to your home and to my home. We need lots of prayer, and we do need your help to stay on the air. Do spread the word about our program. It can be heard on LWRN.net, Liberty Works Radio Network, Mondays at 5 p.m., repeating at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WWCR Thursday evenings, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 4.840 megahertz. spread the word, and we ask the Lord to protect you. He can cast Satan out of your lives. He can help you with your money, with your family, with everything. Lou and I have experienced this. May God bless you. Good night.